I still log about 44,000 miles a year in the air, you know. And,
you had to set some of that aside then when you came to Madison?
No.
No? It's not.
Just went right ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, my custom was not to take a vacation. I would occasionally, if I was going someplace where I hadn't been or Helen hadn't been, I wanted to go. She would pick a couple trips a year and we'd take a weekend before and tie it into, you know, for a couple of days extra. So that I worked most of the time, you know. And, the trips were always a break. And I think rather than just when you're younger, especially, the change of pace. And if you're going to be doing something exciting, you know, like the trip to Russia or the trips to the Air Force, you know, one of the things there was a TMC of patients, 15, 20 patients in an afternoon. Well, you called your shots as you saw them, then you went on to the next base, you know, from Tachikawa to Okinawa or something like that. And again, but you didn't have all of the long-term care and responsibility. You know, you just did mm-hmm. what, you know.
Did they refer to you as difficult cases?
Yes, yeah. So I'd go up visit at a base. Most of the officers, the neurologists, were young men, and I had some feeling of insecurity. And at first when I would do this, I'd feel unhappy because I didn't think I'd accomplished anything because the diagnoses were right, they were handling the patients all right. If you couldn't diagnose them, they couldn't, you know, couldn't be diagnosed, you know. And their method of handling the patients, then I got to realize that this was important in itself. Thank God, if I only got back every other year or so, think of the 700, 800, you know, 700 something days. So it was better if they were very, didn't need me, but if they learned that they were doing that well. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting concept of education, isn't it?
How would you state it?
Well, it was better that if that they didn't need me, and uh-huh. that they learned that they didn't need me.
Yeah, I guess a good teacher should make himself
yeah.
Unneeded eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that your wife, Helen Forster, has
yes.
been sort of a team member all this time.
Yeah, she.
She's been raised the kids beautifully, and they've been supportive of me in everything. And if she thinks I'm making a mistake, she says so. Not meanly or so, but I don't think you ought to do that, honey, you know. And she's handled the accounts, the business of running a household, and we live on a farm, she handles that whole thing. And I've been absolutely free to lead my professional life without any distractions. The income tax papers, she pushes them over on the 15th of April and says, you sign here, dear.
does she ever try to get you to slow down?
No. No, I have now, though. Yeah, uh-huh. yeah. Oh, she did. She went in time to say, you know, you really shouldn't work quite so hard. You know, what do you do?
Let me.
All right.
Just finishing up that, I noticed somewhere in something you'd written, you said that some like doctors always had happy marriages because they were so busy they never got they never got a chance to get tired of their wife.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. I don't like that idea. It may be true.
Yeah, I think that the having a certain amount of problems strengthens a marriage. And in the days when I was in training, well, my internship in Cincinnati, I had $10 a month, and we were married at the end of that time. Interestingly enough, we don't have a marriage license because marriage license costs $2. This is before the blood test in Ohio, 36, 37. And if you were married in a church and read the bands, you know, published the bands, then you didn't need a license. And so the license cost $2, and I didn't have very much money, and we decided that we'd just stand on the band. So this is a point, I like to annoy Helen sometimes at a party, but as the conversation gets around to weddings, and then to remind her that we don't have a marriage license, and then walk away and let her figure bail out with that. But at any rate, we were freshmen in college when we met in the first series, the only series date either of us ever had. And the financial problems of early training in those days, paid nothing the first year at the Boston City, $1,500 the year in psychiatry, $700 for the year in chief resident assistant at Harvard. I had titles but no money. And then the Rockefeller Fellowship was plush at $2,400 that year. I think it drew us closer together. We had to borrow money, we had to hunt to buy things as cheaply as we could and so on. And then the illnesses of the children and so on, all those things binded together, you know. And I think that many of the Hollywood marriages come apart because they're not challenged.
I wanted to ask you about something you said before, the division here at Wisconsin between neurology and psychiatry. I had the impression that had been planned in anticipation of your arrival here, but you say that...
It happened before.
Before. And were they expecting then to have you come and or someone like yourself?
Yeah, I suppose so, because Dr. Reese was getting along then in years.
Yeah. And was there some resistance to this split, do you know?
No, I think there was. I think it hurt Dr. Reese deeply. He had a severe coronary shortly after it. He was a delegate to the House of Delegates of the AMA, and I happened to be his alternate delegate in the section. He was at the meeting in Boston when he heard that he was no longer head of the booth.
Dr. Reisler?
Yeah.
Then chairman of
psychiatry. Yeah. We got along very well. We stood together in the fight over the deanship here at that time, the Bowers fight.
Yeah. How have the two departments developed since that time? Have they grown farther apart, do you think?
Not emotionally. No. I mean, they have very little in common now. The neurology residents don't rotate through psychiatry, I don't think. They didn't toward the end of my chairmanship anymore. They didn't want to. And the psychiatry residents don't rotate through neurology. It's rare for one of them to want to do it, which I think is a mistake. This is off the record, essentially, because I don't see how you can be a psychiatrist without knowing something about the brain. And I don't see how one can be a neurologist without some awareness of personality, you know.
Well, that's the problem, I guess, with specialization, isn't it?
That's right.
We set up specialized departments and teaching programs.
Yes.
It's a common complaint, I guess, in medical education that doctors don't have a broad enough experience. I don't know if there's a solution to that or not.
I don't know. I was one of the JMAs, our son at the last medical DMA meeting, someone was back pounding for the rotating internship again, because even that's gone now, you know, with the PG-1 system.
Well, there's been a little bit more interest in general practice, family practice, maybe a trend in that direction.
Right.
But if you're going to be a neurologist first, I don't know if you can...
You can't, no.
It's difficult enough just to learn that.
That's right.
What about your working with interns, graduate students, or whatnot? You probably weren't directly when you were at Georgetown, but after you came here, then you were more involved in working with the training programs.
Yes.
A lot of students you probably met and seen go other places here, I suspect.
One of the nice things is when you're traveling to come up, somebody will come up and say, I remember you from... I went down to give some lectures at the University of Mississippi a couple of years ago, and I'd forgotten that Jefferson, I'd forgotten, but it didn't occur to me, Jefferson is a heavily Southern-oriented school. As a matter of fact, it almost closed when the war between the states broke out because of so many of the students left to go south, that they almost had to close the doors. And I was down in the here, they had a party, they got, and the Jefferson men got together down there, you know. And I was absolutely amazed, you know, because, well, this was like 78, and I left there in 50. It was 28 years after I left. And,
Well, at Wisconsin, you were saying before that you had the support that you really needed to set up a good program.
Yes.
What exactly did you do? I mean, what kind of new facilities did you have to get and people did you have to bring in to do that?
Yeah, well, first of all, when I came, I brought three residents with me. One of them is Dr. Chun, who's the head of pediatric neurology and was acting chairman of the department for a while. Another one was Dr. Rubio, Francisco Rubio, who's the chief of neurology at the National Institute of Mexico. And the third one is Don Bennett, who's the chairman of neurology. He's the only one who's a chairman in two schools at the same time. He's at the University of Nebraska in Creighton and Omaha. He's combined the neurology programs from both schools into one. And so these were young residents who knew me and knew what I wanted to do. And the program here was in the doldrums, really. And there was no zip about it. It was on two wests on the old 1300 University Avenue. They had 19 patients, a 26-bed potential. They had two patients had been in respirators for over a year, you know. And so there wasn't much stimulating. They weren't going to get many red-blooded Americans involved in neurology when it was running like that. So it called for a turnaround. I had difficulties space-wise, and I trusted Dean at that time. I had drawn up some plans after I visited here of what I needed. At that time, there was a large part of that hospital that was empty, and or part of it, and I had planned to use part of it. And so he said, "Now this is exactly what we need, a man with your imagination." This was Bowers. But he said, "Now I can't promise you everything, but if you come, we'll take care of it." I said, "Well, that's good enough for me," and we shook hands. And when I came, he had a mop closet that he could add, you know, and that was all. And I said, "Well, you what?" Well, he said, "If I would have told you that, would you come?" And I said, "No." He said, "You're here." You know, this is kind of a sleazy way of doing it, really. And eventually, they gave me some old kitchen downstairs and some rooms adjacent to it. And I raised the money to remodel it, and we had some space. But it wasn't enough, and then after I got the epilepsy grant, it was brought in neuropsychology and other parts of the department, and we were badly off for space, and so they rented some space across University Avenue on the second floor. Well, that was bad news, as patients could have a seizure going across the street, and that did happen, and I got help for it from the hospital administrator at that time, so but I had no other way to do this, you know. And the old building at 1954 East Washington came vacant, and that's quite another story. And the university acquired it, and it was turned over to the medical school. And Phil Cohen was dean then, and he asked me if we would be interested in it. It had been a neurological rehabilitation hospital. It made sense. We were only going over there for 3 to 5 years on a temporary basis. I was naive again. It was 15 years before the department moved back because of all the hassle about building this and the delays and so on.
Yeah.
And but at least we had some Lebensraum then for those years.
Mm.
And
that was in the late 60s?
63 we moved over.
Well, there was a problem then with getting funding for the medical school. There was a chronic problem there,
yes,
it sounds like,
yes,
about the time you were coming. Dr. Bowers had tried apparently to set up a more active clinical program for clinical practice, I understand. That was something he wanted to do.
I don't remember that.
Mm.
No. That may have, see, I wasn't here very long before the roof fell in.
Yeah.
How
did that happen? I mean, is it something that's, why was there so much difficulty?
There were a number of factors in that, I think. One, the school was relatively new as a four-year school, and it still had growing pains. It was small. I was thinking that the other day. You walk through here, there's so many people, it's hard to have factions. It was small and compact, and people cleverly got together, you know, and there were factions, pro and con, this and that. And so John Bowers had good ideas, but he was basically, like I mentioned earlier, that we'll take care of you, you know, and I believed him, sort of thing, you know, and he liked to fight, which is not a smart thing to do, you know, he brought in outsiders. I was one of them, and I think that this antagonized insiders, you know, so that there were a number of factors going on at the time, and
apparently the surgery faculty was the final blow. The same issue was bringing in someone.
Yeah, ironically, too, you know, after that deal, when I realized that his spoken word wasn't reliable, anything that we talked about, I would go back to the office and send him a note on it. It's my understanding this is what we agreed upon. If not, please let me know. And he said, when he got there, I'm going to have to get a whole filing cabinet for correspondence with you. And I said, that's the way that... Well, in that fight between him and Elvium, he claimed that President Elvium had told him to go ahead and hire an outside man for surgery. And President Elvium said he didn't. And again, John got caught by not having the thing in writing, you know, if it was true. And so I couldn't help but get a little vicarious pleasure out of the fact that he had to be hung, that he got hung on not having it in writing after what he'd done to me. Also at that time, if I had told you, would you have come? Another thing he did was, right out of the spring of the year, I came, he said, here are your ballots. I said, what for? He said, for the chairman. I said, what do you mean? He said, we vote for the chairman. He said, you didn't tell me that. Well, he said, would you have come? And I said, no. Well, he said, here you are. You know. And of course, I don't know, that hasn't been important anymore, but it was critical at one time.
Were you on the medical school executive committee?
Yes.
How did the deans relate to that committee? Was there a good rapport?
Not really. I think, my attitude was that he's dean. As long as he's dean, he's commanding officer, you know. I did understand that now the democracy of the school, I'd never seen that before.
Mm.
Now, Jefferson is a religion. There's a famous story of Jeff, the dean himself told me this, and I've heard it verified by others. That there was, it tends to be a family school. And at graduation, when you go in to sit down in Music Hall in Philadelphia, there's a program for the graduation. There's also a list of the members of the graduating class who had ancestors at Jefferson.
Mm.
And they'll run back three generations sometimes, you know. And there was a family that had like five or six sons, and six of them, I believe, and five of them were graduates of Jefferson, and they were all out in the state, active in the alumni affairs. And they flunked out the youngest one, so they came, descended on the dean and said, we're not going to support Jefferson anymore, you know, we're going to pull back. And so the dean buzzed, the secretary said, bring in the folder and so on, they brought it in. He said, gentlemen, you're Jefferson, man. What do we do with this student? And then I said, why, a guy, he ought to be flunked here. It was thicker than the blood.
Mm.
You know, yeah.
Mm. And, but in a large public school, it's a different feeling then. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think the whole state of Wisconsin is different, you know. Yeah.
Mm. How so?
Oh, well, it's all of its elections and primaries and voting, and vote, you know.
Politically.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the things that used to bother me about the medical school in those days with all of its voting for committees and all of that sort of thing, advisory committees for this and that, that the business of Congress is politics, but ours isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought we were spending too much time.
Sometimes seem to distract from the real goals.
Yes, yeah. Of course, I guess that's basically kind of a monastic concept of mine. Like my wife takes all the responsibilities of the finances and off of my shoulders, so I can devote myself to.
Yeah, I guess that's the tendency to generate a kind of bureaucracy.
Yes.
It has to. Everything has to go through channels. Let's see. When Dean Eichmann was in charge in the 60s, he was a former neurologist.
Yes, he still is in the department.
I mean, he came from neurology.
Yeah.
But. So was that favorable for
you? No. When I became dean at Georgetown, Desert Doherty, who was my first resident, came with me from Philadelphia, and he's been chairman since I left there. Des says, what does this mean for neurology? And I said, nothing. He said, what do you mean? He said, we don't get anything more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be extremely careful about favoritism to your own department.
Mm-hmm. What about the availability of research funds? You were getting funds from federal sources.
Yeah.
How was that affecting the neurology research then?
Well, I was able to bring in a lot of money for training and research. We went, when I came, there were three residents, and I brought three with me. And when it was six, and at our high point, we only had about 17 at one time. We could scale back after that. And a lot of my men have gone on to be department chairman and so on in academic life, and I'm proud of that. The troop between Georgetown and here, and I've got probably half a dozen of the chairs in this country, overseas. Brazil, one, Colombia, Mexico, the Philippines.
I was going to say a lot of foreign students.
Yeah, but see, they weren't, there are two kinds of foreign graduates that's put into a program. One of them, I wasn't interested in taking people who had road to come. You notice there's a fair number of Filipinos, and that reason for that was I trained the first man when I was at Georgetown, Romeo Apostol. And got him a little grant from the Multiple Sclerosis Society because federal money couldn't go overseas. And he set up a program out there. They didn't think multiple sclerosis occurred in the Philippines. I went over to see him 2 years later and he had six or seven patients already. But Ronnie died of a spinal cord tumor. So I trained the people he would have trained.
Mm.
And fill in the gap. And so that's why they're in a fair number in Philippines.
They came over then.
To be trained here and then go back.
Mm.
And with the Marcos government, some of them didn't go back and change it. And with primarily the people that I trained from other countries were with the idea of going back.
Yeah. Setting up a program or developing things in their own country.
Yes. They don't always do it. Yes.
Tell me, while we're talking about international matters, just a little bit more about your trip to Russia with the medical exchange mission. You were in charge of the mission, and how did you, how were you chosen for that, and what were your responsibilities?
I had Pierce Bailey, who was a director of the Institute, chose me for it, and I don't know why he just did.
Mm.
Actually, I think I know. As dean of Georgetown, there was a group of medical educators who came over from Russia. Nicholas Lacey, who was Under Secretary of State, it was his idea to bring over some mean types and educators. Mm-hmm. And they brought them to Georgetown. And I hosted them there. I met them at a banquet and so on. I hosted them there and came to know some of them. And personally escorted them around the university and got them to talk to the people in their areas of competence and so on. And when they came back, Sarkisov, who was one of their key people, Lacey had a dinner party for those people who hosted them. I forgot where it was. It was at one of the main clubs in Washington. And Sarkisov and I met with the Spanish called Combrazo Fuerte, with the embrace. You know.
Mm.
And Lacey, he had the half of us, and he said, you have to do more of this sort of thing.
Mm.
And I suspect that was how I got chosen. You know.
So you had a chance to see Dr. Sarkisov.
Again.
Yeah.
Within
how long?
Probably about a year. It was shortly after Sputnik when they were here, because I remember being bitched off. When we didn't know at that point that one of those guys was a commissar. You know, and they had a little dinner, and he stood up. He toasted our great chief, Sputnik. You know.
Mm.
I didn't know about the. Commissar in the group, so when I split them up at Georgetown, and said, now you're an anatomist, Dr. Solnitsky, he would like to take you, and you're a pharmacologist, Dr. whatever, and then you combine, he would like you. And then this one guy, he wouldn't go with the counterpart, he went back to the Russian embassy, because he wasn't what he was supposed to be, you know, he was there to watch the others. And the group that we met came back the following year. Clint and I had a party for them at a dinner at my home. And Nichkov, who was a nice old man, son, Santa Claus-like, he met us in the railroad station in Leningrad with his granddaughter, who presented us with some flowers in December and November. You know. But at any rate, when he was at our house, I had a little cart with drinks on it, because they poured the vodka very liberally over. And then each cop had a martini, and I offered him a second, and he picked it up, and one of the guys in the water said something to him in Russian. He said, that said he's drinking. He's a director of an institute, 70. So it's a different quality.
Yeah, and this is sort of a one-of-a-kind trip that you guys made.
Yeah.
So it hasn't really been repeated.
I don't know. They did for a while, I know. Yeah, we were the first one over, you know. Yeah.
Do you think that the influence you had with Pavlovian interest and reflexes that they were developing seems to have contributed a lot to what you were doing? Do you think maybe you benefited the most from the people who went over there?
I think so. Come to think of it, yeah.
It almost seems like it was timed right.
It was predestined.
You know,
Yeah.
How did it change your direction you were going with your research? He'd already been interested in reflex.
Yeah, but didn't really realize it, you know. It's again like I didn't know, I didn't realize I was interested in neurology, you know, so, internal surgery.
Well, I guess they say fortune favors those who are prepared.
Yes.
So, and then I understand that you worked partly as a result of this with Dr., is it Gant?
Where's the Gant?
Gant, yes.
And
Dr. Brock. How did that
evolve? Well, Wolf Brogdon, I don't quite know. Maybe Clint told me about him. I suppose that's it. And I wanted to produce this reflex epilepsy in cats. So I started out with a cardboard box and a light and some electrodes stuck in the brain of the cat. And it was kind of crude. And Clint told me about Wolf Brogdon, so I called on him, and he said, yes, he'd come over. And so he'd stop over once or twice a week and watch us. And he'd sit there and explain all wrapped around. And I learned after a while when he said, you might try
you better the hell try it. Mm. You know? He didn't say, now look, this isn't going to work, you know? And he said, well, you know, you might try 4 seconds of the conditioning stimulus and continue. And I didn't see why 4 seconds, but that's what it took. And ironically, interestingly enough, years later when Hal Booker, the young neurologist, came to join the department, he was working with me on this, and I said, you know, you might want to try it. So after he came back after a month or two and said, it doesn't work, we tried.
They understated
nothing. Yeah. Because then I went down to Arkansas. I was invited to take part in the neurology psychiatry meeting down there. And I gave a paper on the reflex epilepsy. I don't remember which one of them was. I gave one down there. And Bill Reese, who was the head of psychiatry, told me about the Pavlovian Society and suggested that I join it and send this stuff up to the next meeting. So that's how I got involved with it. Of course, we began. And again, you know, it was the man who translated Pavlov's lectures into English, and he was the last disciple in the country, and the one of the few that he just died about a year and a half ago.
So then there were a certain number of people who were following this direction. United States,
yep.
And started to
get in contact with. None of them were interested in epilepsy. And this is what made my work intriguing to them, because it was a whole, you know, they were interested in cardiac dysrhythmias and gastric motility, and also primarily interested in animals. Much of the work was on animal research and long terms of business with humans.
The epilepsy seems to, in some ways, be fairly fruitful area of research for learning about the nervous system. I know I can quote you on that. You said at one time in the 50s, you said that epilepsy is to medical neurology what infectious diseases are to internal medicine. So, what do you mean by that?
Sir William Osler, does that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah.
All right, yeah. Yeah, Osler said, if you know all about tuberculosis and syphilis, you know all about medicine. And in those days, you know, because they're living all. And if you know all about epilepsy, you know almost all about neurology. You know.
Pretty comprehensive.
Yes.
Well, and then along with studying the reflex epilepsy, you were, of course, interested in trying to develop treatment for it. That also
has to do with the conditioning methods, right? Yeah, see, I thought if these things are naturally occurring conditioning reflexes, there ought to be a way to extinguish them by conditioning behavioral techniques. And the interesting thing is that Shannon and I work hard on it, and twice a day, we start in the morning and finish the afternoon by taking these capsules and take 4 at a time, and we give them 4 seconds of light or silence and shock. We take movies of them. We thought they had little lights that came on when the stimulus went on. And we critiqued if he moved his leg, they have focal seizures like this. But he moved his leg before the shock this time. And we looked at the movie and we did. Yeah, it was all him. And we were actually disgusted after a couple of years. And we said, so what did we do? We had them all pushed on the floor and just raised them quick. And we do something else. Just hey, Ray, you know, we've got something. We've proven that you can't produce reflex epilepsy in a cat with an intact brain. Maybe the brain's got to be epileptogenic. And so we later did prove that, but in the meantime, we got so involved with the patient that we had disregarded it anyway.
You had a kind of a negative
problem. Yes, yes. Sometimes. Which was important. Yeah. We couldn't see it.
You were working with Dr. Reed, Parkinson's?
No. It was very
shy. And what about Dr. Matthews?
I dropped the flavor in the FDG Reverse Psychology primarily for the Epilepsy Center. And they did their thing on the test of the patient. Oh, the Dr. Reed said I missed a few minutes ago when we had Arkansas. A little while.
it.
Did you have much involvement with people over in neurophysiology directly?
No. Our residents went through there for quite a while in the beginning. But they,
nevertheless, it was something
that's
important, at least,
for
future neurologists
to
have
that blue-ray face. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, unfortunately, it's not possible, and it almost sounds braggart when I say this, but when I was at Jefferson, the political morale, the general political morale, was an epileptic doctor, was a new teacher. I taught neurophysiology to the medical students, the graduate students, did neurophysiological research. I taught neuropathology to the sophomores and to the graduate students, and did routine neuropathology. No one man could do, one man can't do all neurophysiology, one can't do all neuropathology anymore. Let alone, this was a golden era when like physics was at the turn of the last century. It was all understood and boxed in, except there was something a little peculiar about electricity that wasn't quite understood. But the rest of it was all, and mathematics was a closed science, really, until, her father, Einstein. This was robots, and the picture up there was the gal in the middle. She was, this is something about her, something that you might be interested in. When I was at Jefferson, Dr. Merritt, too, to make fun of the EEG, And I thought, now why would the Alpers and Pharisees and the Red Bendy make fun of the EEG? And I thought, well, I don't want to learn it. They're frozen and they won't change. But when I get older, something new comes along. I'm with Master. Make fun of it. So about 1952, I made Pope the first book on neurochemistry. Now this is that fun. So when I thought the book, should have been written in Sanskrit as far as I was concerned. I had no ability to understand it. But how am I going to make fun of it? It was 20 years since I had a course in geology. Am I going to make fun of this? No. The first bit of money that I got from France at Georgetown set aside, recruited Dr. Robos, and they weren't very chemists. He was a chemist, he was interested in chemistry and nervous system. And so she set up a laboratory and she went on. Left there at the University of California, she got to retire, and her husband, Einstein's son, died. And so, but they, young, it's hard to admit that you can't understand something, but it's better to fill in the gap somehow.
That's become more common all the time.
I was an editor of Neurophysiology General Neurology. It started out as a political journal, and when I can't understand, I'm burning the paper.
My anecdote, I was on the original editorial board of it, and it became a question of what will we name the journal. And I was proposed to name it the American Journal of Clinical Neurology, the official organ of the American Academy of Neurology. Well, this was too much. We dropped off the that's what the fine print about the official work. But then the American Journal of Clinical Neurology, well, it's American, so you can take that off. The journal is patented, and then we fussed about the word journal. At one point, when we were at impasse, I suggested we name it of. That was the only word we weren't arguing about.
Of.
Just of.
And that broke the ice, and we quickly came down on just neurology. But it was written meant to be just for clinical neurology. In fact, the Academy was. And at one point in the Academy, a lot of neurologists were still belonging to the College of Physicians. And they put after their name at the FACP. And I thought that neurology should, and this is our status as autonomy, suggested that the Board of Trustees and our Vice President, President, that why don't we instead encourage our members to be received the letters from the Academy of Neurology. And this was a joke that was laughed down because of the one woman put Fanny F-A-N-A.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was very F-A-N-A. Like Fanny, you know, funny. So I learned something. So from then on, when I wanted to throw something, I went around and talked to one or two of the board at the time. So when it hit the fan, you know, and then all when I was president, I came up with the idea of the section. Because now I'm not sure. Because I can see the Association of Nurse Pathology and the Mental Society and the EEG Society, these are all going. But if there's going to be a chemist, a pathologist on it, we could drop it, and they could. Would be much better if we had these things pulled together, you know, under one tent. ICMA has a second chapter, and it's put that format very well. And this is why I came up. But I did the groundwork, and I sailed through the Board of Trustees with a small office and everything else. So that was the first section, two sections of neurochemistry. But now it's such a big show. Well, the meeting is about 8 days, you know, about 3,000 people. And then something I might go back to a general meeting and courses and it's the whole time.
I don't know what somebody says. Never happened. The beauty of
the grass of the field.
The grass of the field is still there.
It's interesting if you look at the development of the science. I mentioned earlier about physics being a lot of science virtually in China. Their mythology is that way. The development of the same tissue culture. You go through a period of development, the EEG, and you can't understand it. That's how they both potential the whole new ballgame. We move by that start and stop, and it's necessary to consolidate and to get comfortable about what we're doing.
Not only understand it, but don't do it.
Hope that you have time to have it understood.
Yeah. And it takes generations. You know,
doesn't interact with the other. What are you writing on here?
That's your
fundraiser.
Well,
I guess there are. I don't know that they've gone up to court. But see, it's just to you. I don't think it can be done in a formal course. I think the example is so important. And I like it. I think that may clearly be always very careful. So the complaint that the way of drinking is to say the most common cause of the attachment is that you use improper drinking. So you take your seed and cut it at the bottom, bring it up to the top of the middle. And particularly when it's but those are factors they are, because you can't get before you need to know. You come to take them. When they have done those, they have to put back on. Actually, the it isn't really the art. Of that again, it's just being a I don't think there's that old country doctor, Van Pelt, that I told you about when I had the time with you.
He didn't have anything to work on in that baggage. But he sure motivated him. What is the good doctor that I'm talking about? No, that is not for our dog. Better he did that than this world, the cow's back. So I went out of my way on the thing and dropped in on they were right. The old grandfather was there, you know, and the old family, you know, and that was just letting me down. Another minute or so I sat and I was forgiven for the man who trusted the big hand and the children in my contract. That is a good way to get out. Yeah.